Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo, Jonathan Evans, and Steve Ember. But first, this report.
Information technology, or IT, has entered into almost every part of modern life, and higher education is no exception. Yet, while many businesses and governments continue to invest in IT products and services, higher education in the United States seems to be following a different path. Research suggests that many U.S. colleges and universities have limited their spending on IT. Some experts argue this is not only harming the schools and their programs, but also the experiences of their students. A group called the Campus Computing Project studies how American higher education uses information technology. Since 1990, it has published a yearly report on technology-related issues on college and university campuses. In October, the group released its latest findings after contacting IT leaders from 242 public and private schools across the country. It asked those responsible for operating campus IT services about how much school administrators supported their work.
Many of the IT leaders noted that their departments have faced serious cuts to their budgets in recent years. And about two-thirds said their schools have done little to provide them with the financial resources necessary to recover from those cuts. Over 79% of those leaders questioned said budget cuts made it difficult for them to keep their employees from seeking jobs elsewhere. Kenneth Green is the founding director of the Campus Computing Project. He says that information technology is linked to higher education in more ways than most people understand. For example, before students even think about attending a college or university, they often research the school by visiting its website. But that is only a small part of IT's usefulness to a school, Green said. He added that more and more professors are using technology to improve their educational materials and connect with other educators. Schools use online databases to collect information about their students. And students use the internet to do research, register for classes, and even pay for their college education. Green suggested that a big part of the problem is budget issues that are out of the control of school officials. This is especially true at public education institutions, which depend on money from the government. He noted that during the recession of 2008, most state governments reduced their spending on higher education.
The U.S. economy has greatly improved since then, but an increase in financial support for higher education has not followed, he added. Green said it is not as if school officials undervalue the importance of strong, modern IT systems, but it is difficult to keep IT systems operating if the best workers feel they can find better jobs elsewhere. However, Adam McQuinn argues that if schools really understood the importance of IT, they would not choose to spend money in unnecessary ways. McQuinn is with the Information Technology Innovation Foundation, a nonprofit research group not involved in the Campus Computing Project study. He notes the study identifies issues that have been developing in higher education for years. But instead of dealing with those issues, many schools have increased spending in areas other than IT. For example, a 2017 George Mason University study found that colleges and universities added a large number of administrative employees between 2001 and 2011. That number increased 50% faster than the number of classroom teachers added during the period.
McQuinn said that many of these administrative positions do not directly relate to student learning or the success of students, and they come at the sacrifice of important services, such as IT. Instead, colleges and universities should accept that investment in IT products and services can actually reduce operating costs, he said. That is because technology can remove the need for workers to do things like record keeping, preparing documents, and requesting money for research. He added that some schools have tried to spread the cost of things like IT by increasing other costs for students. But with the cost of U.S. higher education rising, schools should be trying to reduce financial barriers, he said. And there should be more efforts like a recent Department of Education program that pays for improvements to IT security training systems at community colleges. The Campus Computing Project's Kenneth Green said that schools need to get a better picture of how well their IT services are operating. His study found that only about 20% of the 242 colleges and universities have a process of examining the benefits of technology on their campuses. We talk about the power of technology, Green said. But it's still the case that a lot of the decision-making is done with opinion or epiphany. We don't do a good job, at least in the United States, about gathering evidence and doing research about our investments in technology. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Now, the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. On today's show about English words and expressions, we're going to talk about bread. Now, most countries around the world have some sort of bread in their food culture. No matter what shape or flavor it has, bread sustains people. It not only helps them to survive, but also to feel satisfied and comfortable. Maybe that is how the word bread got its slang meaning. You see, bread and the raw form dough both can mean money. Using bread and dough this way may sound a little outdated, but you will hear it used that way, so it's good to know. And bread, meaning money, is used in several English expressions. Take, for example, this very current, common, and useful expression, breadwinner. Even though bread here means money, the word breadwinner does not mean someone who has won money in a competition. A breadwinner is a person who makes money for others. They are the ones who pay the bills in a family. They support or provide for dependents. So we can also call a breadwinner a provider. Let's hear it used in this example.
I saw Elsa the other day. She looked so tired. What's going on?
She has a lot of pressure on her right now. Her parents are both really sick. So she is now the breadwinner for her whole family.
Oh, wow. Doesn't she have a brother in college?
Yeah, and her grandfather lives with her. So she has to provide for all of them.
No wonder she looked so tired. She has to support a lot of dependents on one salary.
To throw another food expression into the discussion, the breadwinner in a family is also the person who brings home the bacon. These days, some people also use cheese to mean money. Put bread, bacon, and cheese together, and you have a lot of money. Not to mention a really tasty sandwich. Now, if you are the sole breadwinner for your family, it is important that you keep your job. It would be cruel for someone to take the bread out of your mouth. That does not mean they stole your sandwich while you were eating it. This expression means they took away your ability to make money, your livelihood. And that would be terrible for your whole family. If you lose your livelihood, you could end up on the bread line. A bread line is a line of people seeking food from a charity or government agency. In the 1930s, during the economic depression in the United States, it was common to see hundreds of people in big cities waiting on bread lines. So being on the bread line describes someone who depends on food donations to survive. And that's the end of this Words and Their Stories. I'm Anna Mateo.
The 67th Miss Universe Beauty Pageant will take place December 16th in Bangkok, Thailand. The competition will include young women from around the world representing their countries. But one South American country, Chile, will not be represented by a native Chilean. Instead, Andrea Diaz, a native of Venezuela, will have that honor. Diaz grew up in Valencia, Venezuela. She began training as a model at age 12 at a school there. At 19, she won a pageant organized by her town's baseball team. As Diaz moved along her career path, she also moved away from home. She went first to Panama and later to Mexico for modeling jobs. In 2015, she settled in Chile, where most of her family members now live. The 27-year-old woman told the Associated Press, "I represent the new Chile. This is an inclusive country where immigrants come in search of opportunities." Thousands of people leave Venezuela each day to escape a lack of food and medicine in the country. Its economic crisis has created an almost 1,000,000% inflation rate. Many beauty pageant hopefuls have left Venezuela and have found work in modeling and media fields. Diaz is one of several Venezuelan beauty pageant competitors representing countries other than their homeland. Next month, A Venezuelan competitor will represent Portugal at the Miss World event in China. And a recent Miss Earth pageant had two Venezuelan models who competed for other countries, including Jessica Russo. Russo represented Peru just 1 year after moving to the country. She told the AP, "My dream of being a beauty queen was not going to stop just because I arrived in a new country." The 22-year-old competitor did not make it into the Miss Earth finals, but she is not giving up. She says she hopes to one day win a competition for Peru, the country where her mother was born. I'm Jonathan Evans. Today on The Making of a Nation, we tell about the European settlers who established colonies in the American Northeast in the 1600s. Here is Steve Ember.
The Puritans were one of the largest groups from England to settle in the area known as Massachusetts. They began arriving in 1630. The Puritans had formed the Massachusetts Bay Company in England. The king had given the company an area of land between the Charles and Merrimack rivers. The Puritans were Protestant Christians who had split from the Anglican Church. They wanted to change the church to make it more holy, more pure in their eyes. The Puritans were able to live as they wanted in Massachusetts. Soon, they became that area's largest religious group. By 1690, 50,000 people were living in Massachusetts. Puritans thought their faith was the only true religion and that everyone should believe in it. They also believed that church leaders should lead the local government, and that all people in the colony should pay to support the Puritan church. The Puritans thought it was the job of government leaders to tell people what to believe. But some people disagreed with the Puritans, who became leaders of the colony. One of those who disagreed was a Puritan minister named Roger Williams. Roger Williams believed, as all Puritans did, that other European religions were wrong. He thought the spiritual traditions of the Native Americans were wrong too. But he did not believe in trying to force others to agree with him. He thought that it was a sin to punish or kill anyone in the name of Christianity. And he thought that only members of the church should have to pay to support the church. Roger Williams began speaking and writing about his ideas. He wrote a book arguing that it was wrong to punish people for having different beliefs. Then he declared that the European settlers were stealing land that belonged to the Indians. He said the King of England had no right to let people settle on land that was not his. The Puritan leaders of the Massachusetts Bay Colony forced Roger Williams to leave the colony in 1636. He traveled south. He bought land from local Indians and started a city, Providence. The English Parliament gave him permission to establish a new colony, Rhode Island, with Providence as its capital. As a colony, Rhode Island accepted people of all religious beliefs, including Catholics, Quakers, Jews, and even people who did not believe in God. Roger Williams also believed that governments should have no connection to a church. This idea of separating church and state was new. Later, it would become one of the most important of all the governing principles of American democracy. Other colonies were started by people who left Massachusetts to seek land. One of those colonies was Connecticut. A group led by a Puritan minister named Thomas Hooker left Boston in 1636. They moved inland and settled near the Connecticut River. Others soon joined them. Other groups from Massachusetts traveled north to find new homes. The King of England had given two friends a large piece of land in the north. The friends divided it. John Mason took what became the colony of New Hampshire. Ferdinando Gorgas took the area that later became the state of Maine. Maine was never a colony. It remained a part of Massachusetts until the United States was established in 1776. The area that became New York State was settled by the Dutch. They called it New Netherland. Their home country, the Netherlands, was a great power with colonies all over the world. A business called the Dutch West India Company owned most of the colonies. The Dutch claimed American land because of explorations by Henry Hudson, an Englishman working for the Netherlands. The land the Dutch claimed was between the areas settled by the Puritans in the north and the Anglican tobacco farmers in the south. The Dutch were not interested in settling the territory. Instead, they wanted to earn money. The Dutch West India Company built trading posts on the rivers claimed by the Netherlands. Indians brought animal skins to these posts for use in making goods for buyers back in Europe. In 1626, the Dutch West India Company bought two islands from the local Indians. The islands were Manhattan and Long Island. The Dutch paid for Manhattan with goods worth only about $24. The Dutch West India Company tried to find people to settle in America, but few Dutch wanted to leave Europe. So the colony welcomed people from other colonies and other countries. These people built a town on Manhattan Island. They called it New Amsterdam. It was soon full of people who had arrived on ships from faraway places. Up until this time, the population was mostly Dutch and British, but now one could hear as many as 18 different languages spoken in New Amsterdam. In 1655, the governor of New Netherland took control of a nearby Swedish colony on Delaware Bay. 9 years later, the English did the same to the Dutch. The English seized control of New Amsterdam and renamed it New York. That ended Dutch control of the territory that is now the states of New York, New Jersey, and Delaware. Most of the Dutch in New Amsterdam did not leave after it became New York. The English allowed everyone to stay. They let the Dutch have religious freedom. The Dutch were just not in control anymore. The Duke of York owned the area now. He was the brother of King Charles II of England. The king gave some of the land near New York to two of his friends. Sir George Carteret and Lord John Berkeley established a colony. They called it New Jersey, after the English island where Carteret was born. The two men wrote a plan of government for their colony. It created an assembly that represented the settlers. It provided for freedom of religion. Men could vote in New Jersey, whatever their religion. Soon, people from all parts of Europe were living in New Jersey. Then King Charles took control of the area. He sent a royal governor to rule, but the colonists were still allowed to make their own laws through their elected assembly. The King of England did the same in each colony he controlled. He collected taxes from the people who lived there, but allowed them to govern themselves. One religious group that was not welcome in England was the Quakers. Quakers called themselves Friends. They believe that everyone has an inner light that leads them to God. Quakers believe they do not need a religious leader to tell them what is right, so they had no clergy. Quakers believe that all people are equal. The Quakers in England refused to recognize the king as more important than anyone else. They also refused to pay taxes to support the Anglican Church. Quakers believe that killing is always wrong, so they would not fight, even when they were forced to join the army. They also refused to promise their loyalty to a king, or a government, or a flag, only to God. For all these reasons, the English did not like the Quakers. Many Quakers wanted to leave England, but they were not welcome in most of the American colonies. One Quaker found a solution. His name was William Penn. William Penn was not born a Quaker. He became one as a young man. His father was an Anglican and a good friend of the king. King Charles borrowed money from William's father. When his father died, William Penn asked that the debt be paid with land in America. In 1681, the king gave William Penn land, which the king's council named Pennsylvania, meaning Penn's Woods in Latin. The Quakers now had their own colony. William Penn said the colony should be a place where everyone could live by Quaker ideas. That meant treating all people as equals and honoring all religions. It also meant that anyone could be elected as a leader. In most other colonies, people could believe in any religion, but they could not vote or hold office unless they were a member of the majority church. In Pennsylvania, all religions were equal.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.